Why is it rarely encountered, even in hundreds of thousands of millions of ages? Is that so? Why is it so? Especially since right away we say, now we see this, hear this, receive and maintain this. Let me touch on some analogies and maybe we can clarify this matter so we can truly see this, hear this, receive and maintain this. Since this is exactly our life, and yet we rarely encounter our life. If you lived someplace where there's a long winter, especially someplace where there was lots of frozen over canals and waterways, you might become quite proficient at ice skating. Used it to get around a lot, visit your neighbors, do all sorts of other things. And if you only knew winter, because winter went on year after year, not winter and summer, but winter seemed to go on for a long, long time, you would take for granted that this is the way people got around. And then one day you get up and you go out, put on your ice skates and get on, go towards the ice, and you try to skate, but lo and behold, you sink right into it. Somehow the ice is not ice. It's water has appeared where there used to be ice. Who knows? Maybe there was an overnight thaw. Maybe it went from winter to summer instantaneously. And your old method of getting around doesn't work any longer. In fact, you can't figure out what this is. Imagine you had never seen open water before. Imagine you might never have even walked without ice skates. Now, of course, this is just an analogy that we don't know of anyone that lives in that kind of world. And yet, for many of us, the world that we live in is a world made up of, to a great extent, our conscious thinking and emoting process. And we're used to using that or those faculties as the way we determine where we go, what we do, how we evaluate what should and shouldn't be. More so, this thinking, emoting is vastly entangled with this self-idea that we have, that we use over and over throughout our activities, and it seems to work. I want this, I don't want this, I like him, I don't like her, I shouldn't have to feel this way, I'm glad I feel this way, I'm getting angry because you're saying what I don't want, and so on and so forth. That's the way we operate. And yet, fundamentally, the capacities and limits of that kind of thinking or emotion thought really doesn't go very far in the life that we truly are. It absolutely does not. And it doesn't go far in the realm of practice, which is the ability to be, to attest, to manifest the life we are. See? That's the fundamental awakening of the Buddha, is that when we entangle self, which we do in our thinking and in all the other five skandhas, in all the other ways of functioning, meaning self in the form of grasping, desiring, liking, not liking, then we're guaranteed to suffer, to cause harm, to have stress and dissatisfaction, guaranteed in the life that we are. It's as if you're doing construction on your house and you're pounding nails and putting up wallboard, and that's great. Some of you here do that. Some of you are doing that during session even. And after you've pounded the nails, you go to the windows and want to start seeing more clearly what's there, because the windows are all grimy. But you pick up that same hammer and you attack the grime on the windows with the hammer. Doesn't work. You'll destroy the windows. Now you could say, well, great, I got rid of windows and now I can see out of them. But remember, this is an analogy. We don't see our life, we don't awaken and attest and manifest our life if we attack it with our rational conscious thought. It just can't get there. It can't get there because the nature of that process is limited. There's no problems with it where it's appropriate and useful, but it fundamentally perpetuates, if I want to call it confusion, if I want to say delusion, if I want to say ignorance, it fundamentally perpetuates that. It fundamentally perpetuates self and other. Fundamentally, that's the nature of those human processes. There's nothing wrong with them if we use them where they're appropriate. The problem is they don't help us for what we want in life. because they perpetuate, though they meaning operating in that mode, perpetuates a dualism, a self and otherism, or a self-centeredness, you could say it in all sorts of ways, which leads us to not see who and what we are, leads us to be frustrated in all sorts of areas because those areas cause suffering for us, and yet we cannot, for the life of us, do anything skillful as long as we use the tools that seem natural to us. The tools of thinking in a self-centered way. Emoting out of self-centered entanglement. Perceiving, sensing through the filters of self and other. Even in using simple words to describe ourselves, we describe ourselves in ways that, if I say it, cultivate self, cultivate the idea that the word mind refers to consciousness, conscious thought, conscious rational thought. And therefore the limits of our practice become the limits of what, quote, makes sense, close quote. Therefore the limits of our life become that, even though our life is never limited in that way. The limits of our life become all the things that we hold on to in that way. The ability we have of perceiving become limited by that. It's not that there's any inherent problem in conscious thinking, in rational thought, in emotional thinking. Nothing wrong with those, except that we are so used to them in a certain way, and we so identify them as the whole of who we are, that we are trapped by them, and in a sense they use us. They use us by keeping us going round and round within the confines where we're guaranteed to suffer, where we're guaranteed to be unable to be satisfied, unable to be at rest, unable to see our life as it is. See? Unable to be this non-abiding, if I use a fancy word, unable to be this mind that is entrapped by ideas of Buddhas and beings. See, Buddhas and beings are all this one mind, says Wang Po. Of course, when he uses the word mind, or better yet, heart mind, he's referring to something, I'll say bigger, shouldn't say bigger, something not limited to our self-entangled way of viewing mind, of viewing heart, of viewing ourself. And that, of course, becomes a problem when we translate words. But it's more than that. It's not just when we translate words. When we translate instructions of how to practice, it's the same thing. We translate those instructions into self and other, or into rational thinking, or into conscious emotion, thought. And if we translate our practice into that, then our practice can only go to the limits of that. Or, better yet, our life can only go to the limits of that. And we keep on bumping into limits that we self-impose upon ourselves, self-impose upon our life, self-impose upon this moment, upon this moment. So we say, the Dharma, incomparably profound and minutely subtle, is rarely encountered. It's rarely encountered because we keep turning away from this Dharma that's always, always this life that we are, that we're always encountering from morning to night. Can't be anything else. Can't be. Except because we insist it's not who we are. Or we insist we are something other than that. We insist we are all the various forms of self that we define ourselves as. And each of us does it differently in our own unique way. And it's fine, as I said, if you're pounding nails, it's fine to use a hammer. If you're trying to do the books of a company and figure out what are the cash comes in and what's the payables, and you know, you get the assets and liabilities and all of that, you've got to use certain kinds of thinking to understand that. If you're doing your taxes, you need to fill it out. You can't say all is mind, etc., etc., and send it to the IRS that way. They know you've got to figure out what's been your income, you know, what are your deductions, etc., etc., and then you give them the results and you tell them what you owe them or what they owe you, depending upon your calculations. But if you calculate like that when you're with people, or even at the end of the day, how your day was, who owes you what, and what's owed, what do you owe others? If you calculate like that about your friends and family, if you calculate like that about the air that you breathe and the wind and the temperature and how the day is, then your life becomes limited by those calculations. See, unfortunately, we can even do that in our sitting. We could do it in the process of being present. Now, the process of being present means all the different ways we have of functioning, whether we call it the five senses and mind, or five senses and the functions of mind, whether we call it the five skandhas, which is the body, and then the different aspects of what we call mental functioning. No matter what we call it, if we calculate what that is based on the rules of the IRS or rules of accounting or rules of, you figure out, doesn't make a difference what approach you use. Could be the rules of playing music. In fact, if you calculate music, and I'll use the word calculate in a calculated manner, if you calculate music based on, did it get the right note, was it, and you have a machine to see, then that kind of music might sound technically correct, but there's a deadness to it. You're missing something more. Now, I can't talk much about music. We have experts here who can speak much better about such matters. But it's, again, just an analogy. It's certainly an analogy in terms of our life with family, friends, the universe that is our life. See, the whole universe is our life, except if we tell ourselves, no, I'm going to calculate it based on me being inside this skin bag, skin bones bag, me being inside these things that I can rationally figure out and make sense of. If I calculate my life on that basis, then my life becomes guaranteed to be unsatisfactory. See? So, in one sense, practice, I'll use the word, is cultivating mind. Cultivating mind that's an all-inclusive being, or mind-heart. Cultivating not because you're doing something extra, but because you're being this present moment and allowing this moment to reveal your life by not blinding ourselves. Seeing it directly is really what our practice is about, to allow our life to directly reveal the nature of our life, or the nature of this heart mind, or the nature of, and you could use whatever word you want to use as a synonym. We could say directly reveal Buddha nature. But only if we cease doing, no, I shouldn't say cease, let's say another way. Only if we're not blinded by our usual habits. See? That's why we use expressions that point to the fact that practice is not about attaining something else. It's being who you always are. It's revealing or awakening to what this moment is. See, so we could say, now we see this, hear this, receive and maintain this. We could say, now we see this, hear this, taste this, feel this. Because every one of our perceptions are nothing but the revelation of our life. They're nothing else. There's no place else to go looking for anything. Whether you're healthy or sick, young or old, strong or weak. No place else to go looking for things. And there is no special thing you have to do in order to attest and manifest who you are. It's just that holding on and relying on all sorts of things gets in the way. And we don't even know it gets in the way, because we take for granted that holding on and relying, not only do we take it for granted, we believe it's who we are. We naturally function out of that, naturally seeming, because we've been doing it. You've just been doing taxes too long, and when you start doing that same thing with the people in your family, you have problems. You've been banging hammers too long, and then you go to the dinner table and bang on the table and bang on those who are having dinner with you. Or whatever. See? The hammer is self-centeredness. The hammer is hearing things in terms of self and other. The hammer is believing thoughts that arise. See, thoughts, feelings, all of those are simply the cause and effect of the present moment. They're nothing else, neither good nor bad. They're just cause and effect of the present moment. And cause and effect has further results. See, cause and effect is exactly the teaching of the Buddha, because it's the teaching of the Buddha that everything arises and passes, that it's empty of self, if I use fancy theoretical words. Empty of self meaning that it can appear and it can disappear. When this is, that is. When this ceases, that ceases. But we keep insisting, when this is, it will continue to be. It doesn't cease. So we continue banging the hammers, even though the moment for hammers has ceased. And we don't even see it. So I bring this up because I want to talk and clarify our practice as we sit here together. And the important point to I want to start with is that our practice is beyond the limits of what we rationally know, beyond the limits of how we think things should go. It's beyond the limits of what I want. Not that those are any problem, but we take those and in a sense we go beyond their limits in our effort. Or we allow ourselves to be beyond those limits. We don't have to get rid of them. See? We don't have to get rid of anything. But we simply, if I say it, open it up so that we can be more open. But being more open means just being right here, right here. You don't have to go somewhere else. It's right here, right here. So right here could be this inhaling, breathing, stepping, sitting, hearing, eating, listening, heartbeat, aching back, fears arising, or any of the many functions that you as a human right now have, each to our own capacity, whether we're healthy or sick. Right here is being sick, having aches when you have those. These days, I know when I wake up in the morning, I have to work at getting my bones and body moving, and it hurts in a little bit. I didn't used to. I used to jump out of bed right away. No aches, no pains. Now I know I've got to get the engine going a little bit before I jump out of bed. And even then, there's aches and pains. Aches and pains are just aches and pains. Unless, in perceiving aches, I say, oh, I hurt so much. I shouldn't hurt. Why is this? Oh, I wish it wasn't this way. Oh, it's going to get worse. Oh, etc., etc. Or on seeing someone, we go, oh, not him again. Oh, what's he going to want today? How is he going to talk today? Or, he isn't noticing me. How come? He's not being nice today. Or he's not saying how wonderful, etc., etc. Or simply, if we're sitting and our emotion, thought is agitated, we add on to it, what's the matter? Is something wrong? Why is it so agitated? Etc., etc. This isn't something new. If we think that trying to make our mind be a certain way is some unique 21st century, 20th century, etc., no. The ancestors of practice have spoken of this all the time, over and over. Trying to make it go, make it be a certain way, make it come, are illnesses of the mind. Our non-abiding mind, if I use that word, our non-abiding being, our non-abiding heart mind is the fundamental basis of what is, of this many of you are aware Matsu, when asked, said mind is Buddha. Of course, another time he said no mind, no Buddha. That's just because of our wonderful skill as a human, that as soon as we hear some words, we grab onto them and want to make them into more self by making it into, oh, I know what it is, it's this, it's that. More knowing. So, I've been talking too long, but I want to start with this, since we have these few days of Sesshin, and this is a time and a way that we can clarify practice so all of us can make good use of this unified mind, this seshing time of practice. So I'll stop now and maybe we can speak of this together a bit. And if I use the word have practice be more productive and proficient. So I'll stop here.
I could relate to your analogy about music.
Oh, you're a musician too.
Well,
that's right.
I used to be. I am anymore. But I played guitar in a rock band many years ago, for many years. And one of the things I learned early on in playing with the band is how important it was to learn and practice the song before you went out live to play it with the band. Because on stage, it's important. I found how much of an issue it became when you started to think about what you were playing while you were playing it. It's one thing in practice. You can stop and say, wait a minute, I'm not doing this right. But live on stage, if you stop even for a moment and start thinking about what you're playing or what you're going to play, you're in trouble. Because you're not in tune, you're not in touch with what's going on anymore. And the other thing I learned was how important it was not to take, even when you do make a mistake, or someone makes a mistake, how important it was not to take it personally. Because that also takes you out of sync with what's going on stay on stage. And it adds a little pollution to the synchronicity. And how important it was to let the music carry you beyond that point. You made a mistake, okay, drop it, leave it alone, and let the music carry you on at that point.
Yeah. When you make a mistake, of course, is a judgment. It's fine, because we get, that's one of the functions of our mind, that we can judge so-called mistakes and so-called not mistakes. But when we add on, I made a mistake.
Or you made a mistake.
Or, well.
That idiot made a mistake.
It's not the mistake, it's that I made a mistake that then hinders us right there.
That's holding on.
And it's instantaneously. That's where Dogen differentiates the 10,000 dharmas, advance and confirm self is awakening. Self advances and confirms 10,000 dharmas is delusion. Now, delusion is fine, except that it results in stress, harm, suffering. So, it's okay. Stress is stress. Then we get that too. And I don't... let's see if others have anything to say.
I appreciate the initial analogy about being on the ice and skating, and maybe you've never even been without skates, and which I assume, when you said analogies, like maybe you never really, if one is so caught up all the time, then to be free of that can kind of be, it can be a brand new experience and be frightening. You may have to learn how to do that, which I thought you were saying that, in a sense, these analogies are about practice, and that, when you talked about at the end about being more productive in our practice. Now, I'm going to say something right now, which, because I want you to listen. I'm going to ask you to listen, because you have a tendency to say things to me like, "Oh, you're trying to make a formula out of it," and I'm not trying to do that. Okay, just. But if we're sitting, and the ability to allow, just that it's okay to be here, exactly what you talked about, listening, feeling, the thoughts come up, okay, but to not engage in those. To me, the engagement in the thoughts is sort of like being on the ice when you're not familiar with being something else. That's your limit. But the opportunity to allow being, you know, like you said, last machine, free of and free from Marshall Bond, right? Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to delve into a little more deeply with you is, you know, sometimes it seems like I can actually see that I have a choice. I can actually see that. I can see that there's a habit starting, and that, you know, I can make a choice. But there are times, like when you start out, you know, we're talking about the Gautama from the Sutra, that it's rarely encountered. And you said, is it really rarely encountered? But what I notice sometimes is that sometimes I'm making a conscious choice to be in that, on that ice arena. That it's, that for some reason, you say habit or whatever that is, you know, and it's even though I can see that it's a choice. So what I'd like to explore is, okay, let's talk about, okay, we're here now, and here's an opportunity, this whole sashin, I don't really have to be anyplace else, it can be right here, and how do we go to what you're talking, I mean, just what other things do you want to say about making it not dual? This is my practice, sort of a dual thing, like that's what I think you're saying. It's more, okay, let's just, you know, but when we have the, let's just be here. But when there's that choice, and one can see themselves going into that, then how would you encourage one to just, you know, I mean, I hear the words, but say more. How go beyond what you just said.
When you have to be where you are. So if your practice is still, as you're saying, self-directed, because I'm engaging in, I'm noticing, then the work has to be with, in a sense, taking a step further of opening that up, letting that I'm doing go. But you have to start with where you are. So you have to start with, I am doing, I'm doing. So you do till you cease to be doing. And still doing does. There isn't a way that I can give you instructions in that dualistic way that you're going to be able to follow past that, except to trust that you can. So you keep, in a sense, throwing yourself into it until you're directing, you're throwing yourself into it ceases to be, and it just does. So that's the point. You still want it a little bit in, you know, to try to get clear instructions, and there aren't going to be clear instructions from the outside, because the nature of instructions is that they're dualistic. The nature of how you're thinking about it and trying to follow it is, I'm doing such and such. And in part, you have to discover it for yourself. You can be told, and then you have to see how to go and do it, and then go beyond your doing it. That's why, despite the nature of what you do, you can do it. Despite the nature of, I'm formally practicing, I'm sitting down cross-legged, I'm going to start doing whatever, you have to, I'll use the word, almost grind yourself up in the doing till there's nothing left of you. Then you're completely ground up and just doing. We don't want to grind ourselves up. We still want to direct how we're doing it. And yet, our doing it grinds ourselves up, if I use that kind of image. It's the way it is. And it's fine. So, it's not very difficult.
I'm not saying it is difficult. Sometimes there's a real flow, You know, sometimes I can do something great. Something can be very easy that was very complicated. You know, before the sheep. Although right. This is very easy. I understand that. But I just wanted to explore it a little bit further because I thought that's what you were getting at. But I think what you're saying is you can't really express it, which I understand.
You can express it. In fact, you can't help but express it. You can't help but express it. And yet, there's clear and there's convoluted and muddy expression. And there's clarity in hearing it, despite the fact that it's muddily expressed, and there's clarity and lack of clarity in hearing it, despite the fact that it's clearly expressed. So there's no need to judge and evaluate our sitting, certainly not on a moment by moment or ongoing basis or even by period or at all. Our job is, if I use the word job, is to do and then see what if there's something called for. And when we see there's something called for, we know there's a practice effort. When there's nothing called for, we don't see that there's anything called for. When there's something called for and we don't see it, then we know that it's more entanglement. There's nothing called for to eat and swallow our food. Simply eat. But if we're not eating and swallowing our food, despite the fact that it's going into our mouth and we're chewing it because we're figuring out what are we going to do later and why didn't they give me more of it and how come they serve this and not what I expected or whatever. Or simply off in a daydream while we're eating, then we miss the eating and swallowing. That's even though it's there, we miss it. Okay?
Yeah,
okay. Antonia.
I was thinking about the analogies you were using with the hammer for the taxes and my own places I get caught up, habituated reactions to life not being in my life. And what I heard you saying was kind of come back to your senses, come back to your touch, feel, taste, be present. And from that place of being really present in the sense, the sensorium of the body, it gives some space to make a different choice or to see more clearly the habitual reaction.
Yes and no. I don't quite like the word come back to because it's got two assumptions that we make. One is that we're somewhere else, and two is that there's me coming back to. There is no body without separate from mind. There's no mind separate from body. There's no body separate from world. There's no world separate from this mind. But as a provisional instruction, sometimes we have to say, come back to body, come back to right here. Fine, say it. But we need to know that we shouldn't get trapped by those words. Fine, say, feel what you're feeling. Wonderful. Yet, if you believe there's you feeling this, then down the road, so to speak, you'll get in trouble from that. So, when we're caught up, in one sense you can just be caught up. In another sense, when you notice it, there's that ability to observe and notice is giving you an opportunity to do something skillful because you've noticed it. Until you notice, there's nothing skillful to do. In one sense, the function of sitting upright forces you to notice because distractions are removed, And if you're too caught up, after a while you feel it physically and mentally. If you're sitting in a daydream, at some point sitting upright becomes too boring or too dull or too whatever, and you don't want to continue doing that. You might leave, so be it. You know why? If we don't sit in the Zendo, our life gives us the opportunities to face those same things in terms of the circumstances and our interactions with others and with ourselves, with the universe. Guaranteed. Our aging and illness, or that of those that we love, gives us the opportunity. The changes in circumstances gives us the opportunity. The changes in the weather give some people the opportunity to bitch and moan, excuse the expression, if they are caught in that habit. And what we get from that habit is more of that stress and suffering. But all sorts of provisional expressions are useful. So fine to say come back, but I would encourage you not to use it too much, because that assumes that you are somewhere in here and you are coming back from somewhere else.
So open it up might be
if
a better
if
way
you want to use that word, fine. Uh-huh. Or could be focus in, that's fine too, because sometimes it's open. Open doesn't include just being just this key that you're hitting on the piano. Open doesn't exclude just this chewing of this apple. Or, and you fill in, or what. See, and that's, so whichever direction we go, we have to pull away the other direction. That's the hard part, because we want to get an answer and we want to get a a formula that'll work, because then we could keep using it. See, that's our human addiction. We want to get the right way so that then I'll know. See, that's more of that knowing. I get it right, and then I'll know how to do it. And then I'll know how to do it next time and all the other times, and I won't make mistakes, or I'll know. See, that's the self-advancing and confirming the 10,000 things that Dogen is referring to, which is delusion, which perpetuates delusion, confusion. See, that's why Dogen says forgetting the self goes on endlessly. There's over and over forgetting self, being awakened by 10,000 things, and over, because there's in the practice of Buddha Dharma is always the practice of the self arising until it ceases, or the self-centeredness arising until it ceases. So when it arises, right, there's our opportunity, and it's arising is nothing but the manifestation of ongoing change. See? That's why we say rarely encountered, and then we shift to now we see this. See, now we have this opportunity of, call it, this birth life that we are, to encounter practice. Or, let's say it differently, let's throw away, to encounter the opportunity to not perpetuating suffering and stress and harm. Let's say it that way, so we don't have anything. And all humans have that. That's the opportunity we have as being humans. We don't have to worry about how other beings have that opportunity. And yet we constantly want to turn this life of myriad beings, even this life of myriad beings inside this bag of skin and bones. There are myriad beings, and we keep on wanting to call it self, me. We do. We have a hard time acknowledging that it's other than that. And this is a human tendency. So even where me was extended to a group or a clan or a tribe or a religion or a, and you fill in aura, it still led to, could lead to all sorts of difficulties, stress and harm. Okay. So I don't know if I... Okay. Yes, Heidi.
I couldn't quite hear Ed all the way, but I think maybe it's this. Once in a while, when things you're playing, the music plays you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful when it happens when you're playing for other people. And it's more apt to happen when you're playing for other people. But it's a risk you take.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty amazing when it happens.
Yeah. And the one that doesn't like the risk is our self-centeredness. Because it's not okay to make mistakes. And yet, in a sense, our life and our practice is mistake after mistake after mistake.
But they're okay.
Yeah. They're just mistakes. So they're a take that we miss.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, like, take another. Isn't that, you know, take one, take two, take 10, take 10,000? So we get the takes all the time.
The practice, and to follow up on what Heidi just said, the practice in playing music, at least from my experience, was to take yourself out of the equation. Because once you insert yourself into the equation, then the music isn't playing you anymore. And you run into trouble.
Well, in a way, take yourself out of the equation of your life. Take yourself out of the equation of your practice. But you really can't take yourself out of the equation. That's why Dogen uses the expression forgetting the self. See, as long as you're taking yourself out of the equation...
Turns out you were never in the first place.
No, but you were.
Well, you thought
because
you were.
You see suffering all over.
You believe you are.
No, but you see suffering all over. So you... We can't say you weren't in it until that's so.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just theory. See, it's just theory. And theory is important to encourage us to start practice. It's like an enticement. But theory isn't practice. If you're sitting and you're thinking about all the theories and rules or wonderful things you've read, you're still not sitting, you're not practicing. It's fine, it's important. Hearing the teaching is important, but the hearing is the step to then the practicing. Now we see this, hear this, receive, and maintain this. So you've got to go to the receiving so that it becomes yours, and maintaining it in terms of your functioning. Otherwise, it's not maintained. Hearing is important, and we each hear in our own ways. So we could forget everything that we talked about here, because you've heard it. Now it's for you, for us, together to manifest it, to maintain it in being who we are, which is being practice, if I use that word, or being this mind heart that manifests as our life, or we could say being sitting and walking, and being clear on what our effort is when it becomes evident that there is effort needed in our practice. See? When there's effort needed in the midst of this non-abiding that we are, to abide in the non-abiding, if I use that kind of, or to not be caught up. I shouldn't say abide in non-abiding, that's not right. No. See, because who we are doesn't come, doesn't go. We can't be anywhere else, and yet we could miss where we are. So it's just a matter of doing what's called for here so that we can be awake where and how we are right now. Thank you.